of a dual one. It's part of dealing with the qualifications for an elder, and it's for those that are not elders for learning and growing in the concept of being a one-woman man, how to love your wife. So if you would turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3. If you have been in the church a number of years, this address, this title, this part in the book should be second nature to you. Every year or two or three years, however your church governance work, when you start to replace deacons or consider people for elders, you ought to just automatically think 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1. You've got to do that unless you happen to be decaying and this whole concept is sliding into the background and it doesn't even occur to anybody to look up the qualifications of an elder before you elect them, or a deacon or deaconess before you elect them. 1 Timothy chapter 3. Here's a trustworthy saying: if anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, he desires a noble task. Now the overseer must be above reproach, the husband of but one wife. The way the scripture is written here, it's, I'd almost like to garble it a little bit in terms of our syntax and write it a one-womaned man. You can put that in your notes. That's exactly the way it occurs in the text. It could have been written in Greek as a man having but one wife. But it says, a of one wife man. And so it's used adjectivally. I want you to notice the position of it. It's almost at the top of the list for an elder. And it's important that it be that an elder, and especially the teaching elder, is going to be the model, like it or not, for the congregation about how men are supposed to treat their wives. And God is calling for a good model. Okay, now we can look at, when we start outlining the practice of it, we can look at both some negatives and some positives. In terms of saying some things that are on the negative side, it is not merely a man presently married to one wife, but he's a one-woman man like Job. He's made a covenant with his eyes, which is to say other women are off limits. And it's not enough to say that. Something must occur in the elder's life to make that a reality. It is a major issue where I come from. On a two-university campus, as soon as the sun brings the temperature up to about 54 degrees for part of the day, the whole wardrobe up at U of I and WSU changes. Shorty shorts are out everywhere. People are tanning on the lawns everywhere. And a lot of the ladies are just dumb. If you don't make a covenant with your eyes, you're in trouble. You don't have to be trying to find it. You just have to be on your guard. Job, who was a godly, godly man, just said, I made a covenant with my eyes. I made a commitment beforehand that I wouldn't look at a woman the wrong way. That takes a beforehand commitment. Practically speaking, I find this. You either have to decide that you're going to only look at the faces of other women, because when you deviate from that, your mind starts running. Any comments, men? Is that fair? Thank you. Okay. When I'm looking at the face, I tend to focus on the person. when you look below that, you're tending to think of them not so much as a person, but as something to be consumed. Job 31:1, he made a covenant with his eyes. Second point is he has eliminated pursuing other women, married or non-married. We think of adultery as breaking somebody else's marriage bond, but the qualification for this is more than the qualification in the Old Covenant. Do you understand what I'm saying here? There are a number of kings under the Old Covenant who would not have qualified to be an elder in a local church because they were polygamous. You have to be a one-woman man, period. Well, then the question is, if he has to eliminate all other women but his wife in a certain way, how does he relate to? What scriptural guidelines can you give him for relating to all the other women out there? What's he supposed to do? Say, all other women in the congregation except my wife, please leave. Yes, he's to treat them, right, as... Okay, so if you treat them as a sister... And you have a proper sister relationship, you're protective of them. And men, pick this up. You ought to be protective of them. They may not like it, but you ought to be that way anyway. Be protective of them. That takes a revolution in the way that you look at the opposite sex. When it occurs, though, it's really sweet in the congregation. It means you don't want any other woman's marriage or the possibility of marriage messed up. Okay? It's like you didn't want somebody messing around with your sister, hopefully. Or you treat older women as your mother. That's the two options you have. Any comments or questions on that? Can you picture that? That happened to me while I was at the Naval Academy. After much prayer, finally was looking at women the way I was supposed to, the way that God called me to do it, and it was wonderful to have it happen. There was a young lady who was a daughter of a captain on the base, very lovely young woman, and she started going out with the company commander in my company. Unbeknownst to her, he was engaged. I pulled him aside, pulled her aside, and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "He invited me out." I said, "You don't go out with him." "Why not?" "He's engaged. He's engaged. His motives are not pure." "Well, what's my involvement?" I wasn't involved with her at all. I just didn't want to see her hurt. She really is a sweet Christian woman. She married a midshipman 2 or 3 years later than my class. A guy who had a heart for the ministry. Is that exciting? Okay. You wouldn't want to see a ministry team affected by... You know what I'm talking about? You don't want to see him hurt. You don't have to run through that excess baggage. You treat him as your sister. And it's a great way to go. Okay, another thing that becomes important that way for an elder, and I take this principle out of John chapter 3, verse 19. Let's turn to that. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what he has been done through God. Now, how does that impact an elder? An elder's relationship with other women in the congregation should be done where? In the light. Why? No question. It should be obvious that what he has done has been done by God, in God, through God. Okay? Practically speaking, what does that mean? An elder doesn't want to put himself in a situation where he's in darkness, where he's excluded. Okay? Practically speaking, when I have a woman over to counsel, I contact Mary Lou ahead of time, or my daughters. They're good, by the way, too. I was once talking to my oldest daughter, and we were talking about infidelity in the ministry. And I asked Beth, what do you think about that? She said, Dad, you better never do that. I think I'd kill you. Okay? She'd be safe to have around. She'd be adequate protection. It would be done in the light. It would be done in the light. If you're at a church facility, then you have a secretary, and then you want to make sure that the relationship that you have with your secretary is appropriate, not inappropriate. So you're setting up guidelines, not because you don't trust anybody, but then who is worthy of absolute trust? Apart from Christ, not me. Not me. Yes.
Well, even if you realize that you are not a perfect person.
Right. Right. I'm recognizing that I myself am capable of sin. But I'm also protecting them, too. Okay. Now, I want you to recognize that this is not an unusual problem in the ministry. It's a very recurrent problem in the ministry. There's a guy in Pullman who is a minister in a church downtown Pullman, was involved with other people's wives for 20 years of his ministry. And it finally hit the paper. 20 years. Now what happened is the congregation kept, you know, getting smaller and smaller, and no one could understand why it was diminishing. And nobody would come forth and call the minister to account, because things were done behind the scenes. If a man's doing it right, he should be doing it in his ministry, in the light. It should be able to be seen that his ministry is being done of God. It's just extremely important. Comments? Yes. I have them available, floating through. There have been a couple situations that you've had, where you have to kind of close doors. And I told my secretary, I said, find an excuse to contact me two or three times during this counseling session. Just knock and ask for whatever you want to ask for. So you really do that. You really do that. And there's another thing that's done, and Cindy can probably bear witness to this too, is when you're in a counseling session and they go past the time of your secretary's departure time, you tell her, don't leave me in the lurch. I mean, part of the job description is don't leave me in the lurch. Make sure there's somebody around. Don't walk out on me. Okay? Cindy, has Jim ever told you that? I tell my secretaries that also. Don't leave me in that situation. Okay, so there are things that an elder is not to do when you're relating to the other women that you're involved with in ministry. You just think there's a number of things I don't do, I don't do, I don't do, I don't do, I don't do. Positively, there's a number of things that you do do. And I want to focus on this. Again, the stuff that I'm talking about is not only good for elders, it's a model for all other men. Those of you who are in a mixed environment at work and some woman would like to share her deepest secrets with you, you'd be wise. You'd be wise. Think very carefully where that's going to take place. Don't ever become emotionally attached to an individual. When you start thinking more of her than your wife, just pass off the counseling load, throw up the red flag, and bail out. Not good. But positively speaking, you say, well, what do I do positively? What does an elder do positively to be a one-woman man? And the first thing that he needs to do is run straight to Christ, because in the chapter that we all know, Ephesians chapter 5, husbands are to love their wives the way Christ loved the church. And we know the death part of it, and we know that that doesn't apply to us. And so we think, home free. I mean, is it going to help Mary Lou if I get crucified? No. Does she want me crucified? Not yet. So I don't have to worry about that. No. No, you really do. So what do I have to do? Every man here that's married or is ever thinking of marriage has to know how Christ loved the church. Not just the fact that he was crucified. He needs to know deeper things like that than that. And you say, well, how does his relationship begin with the church? And it was part of one of the things that we picked up as an identity factor on the church. Jesus chose. If you watch the way he related to his apostles, how did he end up with those apostles? Did he say, anybody who wants to be here, show up at 12 o'clock tomorrow and you get to be my apostle? What'd he do? What? He picked them. He chose them. After what? After prayer. If I read the text right, it says he prayed all night. The next morning he chose. He chose them to be with him. Now here's what I find. It's really practical. Some men see marriage as something they were roped into. I'm not going to ask the question tonight, but a good question to ask was, how many of your wives proposed to you? If it happened, turn it around. What do you mean, turn it around? You choose them. You choose them. Don't you think, I was pulled into this. Won't fly. If you're going to love your wife the way Christ loved the church, you choose her. And not only do you choose her, you never forget that you chose her. Do you understand the importance of that? I watched some men, and over the years, they begin to let the way that they think about their wife slide into a different perspective. And it's not that I chose you. You are the object of my love. It isn't by default. It isn't that I have to stick with you. It's I choose you. Practically speaking, how does this work out? Let's take a military example. I was in the submarine force. Anybody knows what happens when a submarine nears a foreign port? A talk starts to fly around the mess hall, the wardroom. What's going to happen when you get to port? What's going to happen when they get to port? They're going to go find some women. The CO, the first CO I had on my boat, when he got to one of the ports that we went to, took his wedding ring off, opened his wardroom desk, plopped it in, and went ashore. You say, no. Why did he do that? He did not want to advertise that he was taken. Well, that tells you where things are going. That tells you where things are going. So what do? You choose your wife. And say, I may be in a foreign port, but I choose her. When you sense the temptation, and being married doesn't make temptation go away. Sometimes being married strengthens the temptation because you know what the physical relationship can be like, and you project that it would be the same with another woman. It isn't. But you project that. Think, boy, am I missing this. What do you do when you're tempted like that? One of the things that I did over and over again in the submarine forces, whenever I was tempted, I went back in prayer and I said, Lord, I just commit myself to Mary Lou again. I choose her. She's the one that you gave to me, but I choose her. She is elect. She is chosen. She is the object of my affection, and I'm never to let that leave me. Practically speaking, the question would be, men, your wife feel that? Do they know that they're chosen? Do they know it's not by default? But do they know their wife is theirs? Commitment is that way. If you're working with a single individual, and this happens in a college community all the time, it happens in other communities too, where a couple get together, they have relationships with one another, and they think, well, we had sex together, we're going to get married. One of the warning signals is there's the way the framework is set up, it's set up for problems already. Why? He may not be choosing her. He may be thinking, well, I just have to do this. Talk about a bad setup for a marriage. Say, hey, wait a second. You need to decide something. You need to decide whether you're going to choose this woman. You also need to decide whether you're going to reject this woman because of your sin. I tell men that point blank. I've done that this year. Okay? To be a one-woman man, you must choose your wife. If you haven't done it before God in prayer, do it now. If it's been flippant prayer, make it intense prayer. It makes a big difference. If you do it that way, you'll find out your wife is not in a beauty contest with other women. I mean, she should have no competitors at all. She shouldn't think like, I have to compete with everybody out there. Do you know what it is for a housewife to compete with all the models going? Talk about unfair odds, huh? She's been taking care of your kids at home. You get home and she's like this. She's not that way. Secondly, when Jesus chose these apostles, what did he choose them for? To be with him. There are ministers that don't spend a lot of time with their wives. But you ought to be with them. You ought to be with them. Be with them a lot. Or better, see her with you. You want her with you. Not merely abandoned to your children. She shouldn't be there just to take care of the children. She should be loved and helped to help your children. So she's an extension of you. In Ephesians chapter 5, it says a man feeds and cares for his body, and so a husband ought to relate to his wife that way. There ought to be times, if you're going to be a one-woman man, that you sit and say, what are my wife's needs? What does she need as a continual input into her life? And then how do I provide that? Now, I don't know whether all men are precisely the same, but my general experience with men is we tend to be pretty much one-tracked. There's a snicker. Do the rest of you relate to me on that? Which is to say, a lot of the stuff that I do for my wife has to be premeditated and not spontaneous. Because once I get going on the track, not a lot occurs to me. I have day timers to keep me from great folly, forgetting key dates. I encourage my wife to give hints. 364 shopping days till my birthday. But I know if things are heavy enough, I'm capable of missing something. I'm also capable of missing key opportunities to do something out of nowhere, to just tell her that I care for her and she matters a whole lot. And it wasn't just because I had to remember her birthday. A husband takes care of her needs, takes care of her as if she were your own body, and your own body signals you. Doesn't it? when I need my hair washed, my scalp signals me. There's another redhead. Is your scalp like my scalp? No. I can do one workout and the salt in my scalp will just drive me nuts until I wash it. Okay. Say, you need to wash it. I can't ignore it. But my wife's needs don't hit me that way. But it says we take care of our wife that the way that we take care of our body. We are to love our wives. And love is an initiative term. It means the man initiates. It's not he responds to his wife's beauty. It's he loves her. Now there's a whole list in 1 Corinthians 13 that's incredibly practical. Don't merely memorize it, translate it into action. Love is patient. Well, let me give you an example of my impatience that stood out in the last couple months. My schedule varies during the week. Monday and Tuesday generally are 12 to 14 hour days. It's kind of typical for me. By the time I get towards the end of the week, you can tell I've been working 12 or 14 hour days. I'm getting tired. So by Friday, which is my day off, I don't get up at 6. If I didn't have the awful habit of having my eyes open before 7, I would love to sleep to 8 or 9. I just haven't figured out how to do that. But Mary Lou, during the school year part of it, gets up that time anyway to teach first grade. And she's got to be at her workplace by 7:30, quarter to 8. So she leaves by then. And part of our main heating in order to keep our bills down is wood heat. So we had purchased a new wood stove last December. And it had something on it that our old wood stove didn't have. It had a bypass on it. And when you light the stove, you pull out the bypass so that the draft goes straight up the chimney. When it does that, it just really starts easy. It's a neat place. Well, I normally get that going, but when Mary Lou was up that particular morning, rather than wake me up, she just was doing it herself. It was a cold morning, and she was there, and that fire wouldn't start for anything. It just wouldn't go. And you could tell things were getting a little frustrated, and I came downstairs, and I look at her, and she says, I can't get this fire going. I've been trying to do it. This is the third time, and it won't go. And I look at it, and I said, the bypass isn't open. She said, well, I didn't know that. I said, it's the third time I told you. By the way, it was the third time I told her. It did not matter. That did not matter. Love is patient. Love is patient. And I could see I'd done wrong real soon. I mean, she was fragile. She was trying to pull everything together at the last minute and get out the door so she could be to her work on time. And the only reason she was pulling this together was to try to not wake me up. So rather than preach further on the importance of a bypass being open, I just went over and hugged her and I said, thanks for trying. It was smart. It was smart. Love is patient. Love is patient. And things that are obvious to a man sometimes are not obvious to a woman. Even if it's the third time that you tell them. Because they, when you told them it was the third time, they had three or four other balls in the air. Any comments on that? Do you see how practical it is? Just thinking, am I patient with my wife? Love is kind. What kind of kindness do you do for your wife? Do you open the door for her? When you come home, do you relieve her of the watch if she's been working with the kids all day? One of the things that I am particularly disappointed with men about is their slowness in complimenting their wife before their peers. I made it a commitment that I've tried to keep over my life that no one would commend my wife more than me. Now, she's a good wife. If somebody recognizes all of her good traits better than me, I'm in sin. So I've tried to make a commitment to notice the good things, and I still miss. But I know I give her more compliments than anybody else. Because love is kind. The other thing that men need to do is they need to compliment their wife in front of the children. Every once in a while, I have made the mistake of correcting my wife in front of my children. That is normally a very poor idea. Love doesn't envy. One of the ways whether you find out how much you appreciate your wife is when she gets recognized a lot for something that she's done really well. And whether you can rejoice with her and think, that's my wife. Or whether you think, how come the spotlight's not over here? I mean, she's just my wife. Okay? Love does not envy. It doesn't boast. I like an older version on that. It's not puffed up. Another way to word that is love is real. It's transparent. What it looks like, it is. It's not self-seeking. It's not short-tempered. It doesn't keep a record of wrongs. Now this gets nitty-gritty, doesn't it? I mean, who's closer to you than your wife? The chance that you've had to offend her have been greater, and her chances to offend you have been greater. What occurs at short range. So do you know all the things she's done wrong this last year? If so, why? You should not know, because you should not be keeping records. They should be naturally deteriorating. Love rejoices in the truth. Okay? When your wife does godly things, does it excite your soul? Don't you know some men whose commitment to church deteriorates because their wife so outshines them? Okay, that should never happen. Because real love rejoices with the truth. If your wife is real close to the Lord, praise God. Praise God. It's wonderful. Love protects. Love protects. One of the things you want to do is protect your wife from the kids. Sometimes they're merciless, aren't they? You have a way that just can change things in the home by saying, you can't treat mom that way. You got to treat mom with a lot of love and care. Love perseveres. That means it keeps going. In our churches, you just ought to see the page on the paper where it catalogs the length of marriages. And we ought to just have lots of them in the 40s and the 50s, and where God really allows some longevity to get in, a 60 or so, get in there. My mom and dad were married 53 years before mom died. It's a good example. It's a good example. We need to be that way. We also need to encourage people who have gone through the trauma of divorce to stay faithful in their second attempt. And not say, well, you blew it forever. Forget it. One of the things that you can say is, a man who does this is respectable. A woman that has a man like this just has a treasure from God. God help her if she doesn't see it. And Dick, there are women that don't appreciate what they have. I know that.
Yep. How do you address this in terms of human society today? Our culture that's an anathema to our culture today, at least the popular culture. That's an anathema to the culture at work, which you work with women. And it may not be because they feel that way, but our culture today says, don't necessarily, those are nice words, but that's not the way you need to act in terms of even reaching out to protect, you're saying a treating a sister in Christ from a protective side. In many cases, that's looked at as being very condescending, could even be looked at as being sexist.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it is true that the society level has deteriorated a lot. There's no question about it. But one of the things that we want to do is not listen to them too much about how they react to that. If they say it's condescending, say, if you were in my home, it wouldn't be condescending. What I found is that the women who have actually seen, who are worldly even, and are feminist, who have seen the relationship between Mary Lou and I, will say something like, well, that's fine for you. They won't say, well, you're condescending to her, because they know she senses the blessing of God on it, and she's glad she's in the situation. And they don't see the thing from the others, but they will.
In my workplace, for instance, for how you treat women, a lot of things that used to be green light, clearly green light, those kind of things now, we've moved into yellow light. The aspect of opening doors, from the aspect of carrying boxes, from the aspect of doing all kinds of things.
Right. Right. And there, I think, part of the way that you handle that is by, one, if it's permitted within the ranks, you ask permission to do it. And if they say no, it's just that you respect that. But I find still, with as awful as that is in permeating society, I still open doors for women, and every once in a while I even get a thank you out of it. Still happens.
If people know that you care about males and females, I mean, you're concerned about them as people, you know, and showing God's love to them, whether they're males or females, in the same, manner. But when I come to a door, somebody's coming behind me, I hold it open whether it's a male, female. You know, I mean, I'm probably more likely to hold it open for a woman.
Right.
And women see that. You know, so if they're the type that would be offended because they're a feminist, they have no leg to stand on because I'm not holding it open because they're a woman necessarily. I'm going to be more likely to hold it open for a woman than I would a man.
Right. Right, just being generally polite.
Yeah, and worry about it.
Yeah, we do. I think there's, I think as mentioned by both Scott and Dave, there are some situations now where we're going to have to find out where we don't hold a door because they take it negatively and tell us not to. But I can tell you, one of the things that's very effective, and it has been a problem for years, and Christian men can be wonderfully different, and that's just to talk well about their wife on their job. That's different. Isn't it? You rarely hear that kind of a thing. And it sets a wonderful pattern. Other women around you think, oh, they got a good relationship. And they're less likely, doesn't mean it would rule it out, but they're less likely to try and violate that relationship. It basically says poor hunting ground there. It does. It really works that way. I tell you, that makes a big difference. It's one of the things that I've seen that really just sets men across, so that you keep your wife in mind, and where you just hit a natural discussion, you just describe some of the neat qualities of your wife. Very, very effective. Well, how do you discern with an elder? And it probably comes more to a situation of a teaching elder more than others, but not just that. How do you find out whether an elder really is in fact a of one woman man? I mean, how do you get to the root of that? I'll make some suggestions, and maybe you can also interject a few. One, you ask his wife, are you secure in your husband's love? How do you feel about getting into the ministry? Does it worry you? Are you concerned? Today, do you know that when you're doing a lot of things that the church used to do normally right now, there's always the danger of a lawsuit hanging over your head? I'm guessing that pretty soon magazines like Christianity Today will say something like this: get a written signed statement by the applicant that would give you permission to research his background, to go to his congregation, to go to any place of secular employment and ask about his relationship with his wife. But how are you going to find out unless you probe? Okay? So I'd say ask the congregation. If there's a secular employment, even better. Ask them. How's it come across? If they have fellow elders, ask the fellow elders. How's this guy's relationship with his wife? If an individual comes out to candidate, better to have them bring wife along. Even better, send somebody back to where they are. Don't hear that done too often. Observe them together. Is it obvious that she's responded to his love? Is he polite, protective, affectionate? Is it affected or affectionate? A lot of times you can tell the difference. You can tell it both by what he says and her reaction. Oh, I haven't heard that in a long time. Does he glory in his wife? Doesn't it say that woman is the glory of man? Ask him. Again, these used to be things you didn't think you had to ask. But ask an elder, have you ever been unfaithful? What is your sexual orientation? I'm sorry, you have to ask it. Have you ever been divorced? I know there's one particular denomination in the Northwest where the divorce rate among the ministers in one district was 75%. Has your wife been divorced? Are you working through any special baggage? Are you or your wife working through any abuse problems in your background? Have you ever been involved with pornography? If so, when and to what extent? I think you find you just have to ask. If at all possible, get into the couple's home. Boy, you can observe an awful lot about a couple in their home. You can just see a lot. So that's really practical. Yes?
You started off by identifying, explain what you mean by setting that apart.
Okay. Let me restate what I said just so you catch it. I didn't say teaching elder. I said primary teaching elder. Okay? And the reason that I said primary teaching elder is most often that's the individual that comes in from the outside. And that's the one that typically on the American scene is done basically with a beauty contest. You come in, you preach Sunday morning, you preach Sunday evening. If you stay a few days, you might catch a midweek service. That's max. You've now hit the maximum. I mean, if the guy's been in the ministry for a while, he ought to have 3 good sermons. Don't you agree? So, well, okay. I would think you'd have 3 by that. So you can get a feel for whether he maybe has an ability to speak, but your access to his life is very minimal. And if you looked at 1 Timothy 3, the preponderant focus on that passage is on what his life is. And so you got to get at that. So the focus is on the predominant teaching elder, the one who's going to carry half to three quarters to 5/6 to 9/10 of the preaching load and therefore probably be recompensed in the church. But that could happen for an associate pastor as well, and the requirements shouldn't be watered down, or a youth minister or a Christian ed minister. Anybody that you're bringing in from the outside, you just want to pursue these things. It really is important to take it slow and do it right. if the individual's not willing for you to examine his background like that, just throw him out of the pile and proceed on without him. You will have been saved great grief. Okay? So we've looked at the matter of one woman, man, and we've looked at it at three levels. First of all, it is a requirement in the church. The elder must be this. He has to be a one-woman man. It's not just that he runs back to his strong box and pulls out one marriage certificate and says, "See, I qualify." Years ago, I picked up a comment on the pastoral epistles. I don't remember whether it was 1 Timothy or Titus. And I read the introduction on it, and it said the requirements for an elder were really pretty easy. And I went, is this guy not in the real world? Does he not know that I could take the list to the churches and I would disqualify over half of the men present? Is he ignorant of that or what? Right. Yeah, and the requirements. Now, there are patterns, and it doesn't call for perfection. If it says here, for example, an individual is supposed to be not pugnacious, not an individual that loves to fight. Well, Paul, before he was a Christian, characterizes himself as a violent man. So it's pattern. But it is pattern. It isn't, well, he repented last week, or the year before, or 2 years before. It's a pattern of living that's well ingrained, can be recognized by outsiders, insiders, and all of the above. It's a model for the church. It's what you're telling the rest of the church to really be, not just what's said up front, but what's modeled up front. There are negatives involved with that, and they're negative to be modeled by the whole body. There are things that are inappropriate for me to do with another woman. I ought to just have them in my head. It includes a covenant with my eyes. It includes guarding my heart. It includes never letting my affections with another woman compete with those of my wife. It includes making sure that things are brought into the light to protect me and another person and the church. So there are things that are negative, but there are a lot of things that are positive. And I think as men, we just have to consciously do them. If it's been a while since you perceive the fact that you chose your wife, get before God and put beef that up where it belongs. God, I chose her. She's the woman of my choice. She ought to feel choice. She ought to feel chosen. She ought to not feel like I'm just doing all that I do out of a sense of obligation, even to please the requirements of the church. That should not be the case. So there are a lot of things that I just need to do, and I need to consciously do, and I need to give myself sacrificially in that. And then there are ways that in terms of the actual recognizing of elders, you just need to know, well, how do you do that? Just what are the mechanics? How do you get at that kind of information? And a lot of it can be gotten at. If it seems embarrassing, don't just kind of let it shift to the bottom of the pile. Don't forget to ask. Ask. If you need permission, get permission in writing. But find out. Find out. Okay? Hope it's been a blessing to you. Let's close in prayer. Our Father in heaven, you have lofty purposes for the church. You have lofty purposes for us as men and women of the household of God. And we ask for help. Our world is in a sick state, and you know that. And we have our own temptations, and we know that. We long to be as you call us to be. And we long to carry out what you say must be. Help us in that. In Jesus' name, amen.